please refrain from getting up and down.
Up and down during the speakers. But you must please do so quietly. If you're going to smoke, we ask that you please smoke away from the building. Also, we ask you to refrain from smoking e-cigarettes inside the building. If you find it necessary to smoke, please take it outside. Please be respectful that as we're guests of the church. Tori, Jordan's our first speaker tonight. Woo!
Hello everyone, my name is Jordan and I'm an alcoholic. Wow, there are a lot of people out there. Jeez. Alright, like I said, my name is Jordan and my sobriety date is March 1st of 2016. I'm excited to be up here speaking and a little bit nervous. I remember my first time coming to this meeting. I was nervous to even be in the room, to be completely honest, let alone, you know, be up here speaking. It was intimidating. There was a lot of people. But I've found that this meeting, it gave me hope that, like, not only could I be sober, but I could also be successful. Like, I love coming to this meeting and hearing how, that people not only stay sober, but they go far and they have enjoyable lives and they help others in the process. And so let's see, where do I start? I guess I'll start, fairly normal childhood, moved around a lot. That's about the only difference between me and, your average bear is I moved around a lot growing up. I was born in Washington State, moved across the country to Minnesota, and then New York, and then back to Washington. And I didn't really have any problems in school. I guess friends wasn't that big of a deal either. I did have a feeling though that I never really fit in. Like there was something that I was missing that other people had, I don't remember my first drink, but as people say, I don't remember my first drink, but I do remember one of my first drunks. And my parents were going out of town, which was rare because they. Even though I wasn't drinking, I still got into trouble, so they didn't like leaving me at home all that much. And so they left the house, and sure enough, as soon as they left, I managed to get into some trouble. I invited some friends over to my house, and we got into their liquor cabinet, and the same old story. I immediately felt a sense of comfort at ease. I felt that I had arrived. That's what I felt. I felt like this is what was missing in my life. And I was young, I was 14 years old. And at that point in time, I had a new priority in my life, a new master. And school didn't matter anymore. What mattered to me at that point in time was, I thought it was the newfound friendships that were suddenly appearing in my life. That's what it initially started out as. It started out as, a way to adventure, to explore, to meet new people. And then that's how it started out. It started out as a lot of fun. It started out as me, having a social life, I had a social life. I had friends. I had a hobby. I considered it a hobby. I really did. It was a hobby. And as time went on, it wasn't a hobby. It was not. I remember when I was 16, I got in trouble for some dry goods and at school. And one of the requirements was for me to go to outpatient, and if I wanted to continue going to school, and they made me go to one of these things. And I was 16 years old, and at 16, I looked very young. Like, I probably looked like I was 13. I looked like a little kid. And I went into the meeting, and, everyone's all like, if you don't stop drinking or drugging, you're going to die. And, I'm like, all right, these guys are something else, And And, you know, that was my attitude for a long time. It wasn't until, you know, I was around 18 when all those, you know, when all those warnings that those people had told me about started to come true. You know, the arrests, the lost relationships, you know, dropping out of school, just truly destroying my life and everyone's life around me. Like, I was so consumed by what I was doing that I couldn't see that everyone I came into contact with was just, you know, was getting hurt, you know, and I was throwing everything away. Not long after I turned 18, I got a DUI and I got arrested for my first time. And again, they made me go to one of these outpatients. And this time, if I didn't comply, I was going to go to jail. Well, I did that. I went to jail a few times. And because, you know, I just can't stop. I don't know. I can't stop. And, it was a matter of like, it was 2 years of me going in and out and then, you know, racking up a couple other charges before I truly came to a point of, I felt hopeless. I felt like this was something that I can't beat, you know. Because for a long time I thought I could beat it. I thought, these guys are wrong, I'm not an alcoholic, and I'm going to figure out a way to drink without suffering consequences. And it wasn't until, I'd say I was probably like 19 or 20 when I realized that it's just not working anymore, you know. And I went to rehab for my first time. And I remember one of the they had meetings come to the rehab, and this was in Washington State in a city called Spokane. And they would bring meetings into the rehab, and a gentleman came in, and he was in the Vietnam, you know, he was older than I was, but he was in the Vietnam War, and you know, and he said some really inappropriate jokes that I'm not going to say about, which made me laugh, and I thought that was pretty cool. And then he spoke about how he had found something that allowed him to stay sober and live life successfully. And, you know, and talked about how he had a kid and how he had a wife and how he had a career and how he was happy and he didn't think about using. And that was my first glimpse of sobriety. It's my first feeling of, like, hope that maybe there was something else, you know. And because rehab really didn't teach me anything besides like what triggers are and stuff like that, you know. And that wasn't enough for me, you know. Like I dipped my toes into AA for another 3 years after that. I was not willing to dive in because it was scary. A lot of the stuff they told me to do, like, you know, asking for help and admitting that, you know, admitting that I'm powerless on a daily basis, like, I don't want to ask for help, you know, that's not how I was raised. And it took me a long time to truly surrender. This time coming back in, my rock bottom was not nearly as bad as it has been in the past, but I was just emotionally and spiritually wrecked. And I knew that my life could be better, you know. And I remember getting off work one day and I was having a fight with my girlfriend, and I decided to go to the dry dock, the Thursday night beginner meeting. And I didn't know it was a 1-2-3 meeting. And I went there, and some guys talked about, you know, the stuff that I'd heard before about, like, just staying sober for the day, you know, like not focusing on that long-term sobriety at the beginning, how they were staying sober for the day. As long as I can make it to a meeting for today and then wake up in the morning and pray and go to another one the next day, then they're all right, you know. And they said something along the lines of, if you woke up before me today, you have more sobriety than I do. And, you know, I don't know if that's true or not, but I know that that day it made a lot of sense to me. And I grabbed a hold of it again, and that was March 1st. And the past few months, a lot has happened, you know. Like, a lot of good things have happened, you know, like cars, and the relationship with my girlfriend is 1,000 times better than it was, because that was on the outs. That was just getting to a point where she was sick and tired, you know, of enabling me, sick and tired of me using her. And like today, it's great, you know, like I actually do things that she wants to do, you know, which is out of the ordinary. And, you know, I have a job, I'm saving money, like I have like hopes that maybe one day I'll even, you know, I might be able to own a house, you know. And that was not something, I didn't think that was really possible for myself, you know. You know, and there have been some struggles as well. I'm not going to lie. Early on in sobriety, my girlfriend got in a really bad car accident. And I was on my way back from a detox center down in Largo, I believe. Largo or St. Pete. And I didn't answer the phone because I was at the detox center. And But I got a message. I heard a voicemail. And it was someone screaming. And so I called back the number, and a woman had informed me that my girlfriend had been gotten into a car accident, and that she didn't know if she was all right, you know. And, you know, I was terrified, but I was surrounded by people in the program. And she was fine. Her friend did not make it. But, like, to have them with me for that was, like, it was powerful, you know. And I made it through that, you know. And that's not something I could have ever done before, you know. So, give me a second. This program works, you know. And I truly was hopeless, and I was just hopeless enough for to actually listen and take some suggestions, which is, you know, amazing. And it worked for me. And if it worked for me, it can work for anyone. So, thank you.
Jordan, and now Tori will come up and read the traditions.
I'm Tori, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions of AA. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
All right, Jordan's going to come back and do the chips now.
Here at Fourth Dimension, we have a chip system to celebrate different lengths of sobriety. The first chip that we give out is a silver chip for anyone who wants to give this way of life a try. And that was Erica and Pete. Is there anyone with 1 month? Shannon, Rosie. What is it? Shannon?
Rosé.
And George, I think. Or, 2 months. 2 months.
Yeah.
Now you get. Now I forgot the name. Sean. Two.
Okay.
Exit stage left.
Cody and Helen with 2 months, and Sean with 3. Anyone else with 3 months?
No.
That was Drew with 3 months. What about 6 months? Daniel, Lori, and David with 6. And then we have a purple chip for 9 months. And that was Hillary, Corey, and Robert with 9 months. Anyone with a year? Anyone celebrating a year? What about multiples? Angie, how many years do you have, Angie?
2 years.
Oh, all of 2 years. Angie, Steve, and Chris for 2 years. If you haven't had a good day, get yourself in the higher power of hand.
It's good stuff. A lot of people picking up chips. Good stuff. All right. Now we have the main speaker of the night, Bob H.
Done. Hi everybody, I'm Bob Haywood, I'm an alcoholic. There's an empty seat here. Somebody can have the seat. Welcome to everybody who's new, whether you said you were new or not. Welcome to our visitor from Akron. You're here for a month? I'm here 5 years, and it's taken me 5 years to get AA on track here. So don't try to change it in your one lousy month here. Well, I spoke to somebody from Al-Anon. Welcome to anybody from Al-Anon. My sobriety date is April 23rd, 1988. And my home group was the Shoreham group way out east on Long Island. That's where I got sober. They gave me something nobody ever gave me. It was my first 3 years of sobriety, and I'm grateful for them. And thanks, Jordan, for sharing. Great. I can't believe your short time that you could talk like that. It's just, it was amazing. It's knocked me out. I got sober in the Shoreham group, and we had to speak at meetings, and we had a person had the commitment to go to a speaker meeting commitment thing every 3 months, and they would fill up a calendar, and you had to put your name in it once a month, and then my sponsor told me I had to check to see if my name was added, because they'd have a team of 3 or 4 of us go out and speak. And I remember the first time I had to speak, I was really nervous, and You know, if I had come here like that, I wouldn't have had problems. When I was born, the doctor should have slapped me in the ass and sent me to a meeting. And my life would have been perfect. But anyway, I had to speak, and I drove out to a town called Matatuck, Long Island. And population, that's all the people that live in Matatuck. And I'm nervous. I drive all the way out by myself. I didn't tell anybody I was speaking. And I show up. They had a small podium sitting on top of a desk. I had to stand at it. And two people were at the meeting. And so I stood up like an idiot. And they were really, these people were old, like 50, 55. And I said, what do I do? There's only three of us. And the guy says, well, he says, I'm just a farmer. He said, but when I go out to feed the cattle, if only two cows show up, I still feed them. So it was a great analogy. I thought, oh. And unlike tonight, I didn't say, when am I done? And I spoke for about an hour and 20 minutes. And I just bled my heart out. I don't even know what I said. But when I was done, I said, how'd I do? And he said, I'm just a farmer. He said, but when I go to feed the cattle, if only two cows show up, I don't dump the whole load. So I'm not going to dump the whole load. On the way here, I asked my wife to look up, I do this a lot, driving, I said, would you look up the word interpret? And she looked it up, and it means explaining the meaning to others. And I think I needed an interpreter when I was born. People would talk to me, and I wouldn't understand what they said. And the same thing sober. It's men talk and women talk, you know. It's, you know, I say to my wife will say to me, you want to go to a movie? I say, sure. And an hour later, she comes out dressed to go to the movie. I didn't know. I thought you meant next month. I didn't know it was now. And it goes in the reverse. I say, you want to go for a bike ride? She says, sure. 3 seconds later, my hair's done, my flip-flops are on, and I'm out the door. And then 20 minutes later, where's Sharon? And because I don't say, you want to ride the bike, when do you want to ride the bike? Or when do we have to go to the movie, that type of thing. It's an interpretation that I don't understand. And I hear things differently than other people. People say things, I hear it differently, you know. My wife, my first wife, I've been married a few times, my first wife would say things. I never realized she complained about my drinking, and I'm sure she did, but I just never heard it. I didn't hear that. I didn't hear, why are you staying out late? Why are you not coming home? I didn't hear that. What I heard was, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad, you know, and I just got defensive. And my mother would always wait up for me, as mothers do, you know, and I'd come home loaded 1-2 o'clock in the morning, and she'd say, drunk again, Bob. I'd say, me too, Mom. I heard it one way. At one point, Jordan put it great, a hobby. At one point, alcohol was fun. Alcohol took me away. And you know, it gave me things that it helped me survive. I could not have survived without alcohol. I could not have made it to the point of when I got sober without alcohol and drugs, you know. I've heard speakers up here, they say, well, I drank alcohol. I raped my mother and sister and my brother's dog. and I also use drugs. I hope I didn't offend anybody. I couldn't have lasted as long as I did without alcohol and drugs, you know, and it was fun. And then at one point, it was no longer fun, it was just trying to survive. Alcohol and drugs beat me so much that by the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was willing to do anything to get sober. And I joined the Shoreham group out on Long Island, and it was not something that I meant to do. I just did. I walked into a meeting. I was living on the streets of Long Island. I was sleeping in dumpsters. I had had a business in the town of Port Jefferson. It was a successful business. And I was in real estate. I had two homes. I had the cars, the second wife, all the things. And everything that you needed, you know. And it was never me the problem, but by the time that was over, my second wife, we were only married about 8 months and she died of cancer. And by the time she died, we were only married 8 months. We knew each other maybe 12 months. And by the time she died, I wasn't allowed at the funeral. There had been an order of protection against me. Now, that's not the man she married. That's not the way I intended to be. But alcohol and drugs did that to me. I was angry that she had cancer. I was angry with her, I took it out on her, everything else. And I just couldn't control it. It was just full of anger and rage. And so I was living on the street, sleeping in the dumpster, and walking back and forth. On the bottom of this hill in Port Jefferson is a delicatessen, and they used to get donuts delivered Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, boxes of donuts. And I'd go down, steal two boxes of donuts, bring them up to the liquor store. They'd give me a pint of booze or a pint of wine. Booze. Just to be clear, I'm an alcoholic, not a wino. It's an elitist attitude, you know. But they'd give me enough dope to shoot up. And I would bring back the donuts. And this one day I'm walking down there and it's ice cold and it's raining. And I'm going by a Catholic church to get out of the rain. It's 7:30 on a Monday night and people are filing into church and they're having a novena. And to the Blessed Virgin. And I'm born and raised Catholic. I knew what the novena was about. And I just went in to get out of the weather. And during the novena, they pause and they say, this is a time to say a prayer for your own intentions. And I was in a complete blank. What am I thinking of praying for? And I just asked for the anger to be removed. Because all I would do was express anger. And I did that, and I left when the novena was over, and I went down the block, and stole the donuts, and went back up the hill to do my job. The following Monday, I did the same thing, and I did that for 9 Mondays in a row. And the belief is if you make an obina 9 times, your prayer is answered. So I did that for 9 times, not purposely, I just kept doing it. And that very last Monday, I went down the hill, it happened to be really snowy, and this was in January, February, and I went in, I said the same prayer, and I left, and as I continued down the same street I walked all the time, there was a church another block down, it was a Protestant church, and there was a bunch of people outside with cigarettes and coffee, and I knew it was an AA meeting, I just knew that. I had tried it once before, back in 1981, and this is 7 years later, and I couldn't get sober in 81. And if you're new, it's important that you join a home group. I joined a home group in 1981, but I joined the wrong home group, so I couldn't get sober. There were people in that home group, they were divorced. Some had been in jail, some were unemployable. Some used drugs. And I didn't identify with one of them. I was married, I had a job, I didn't do drugs. But 1988, when I came back, I joined the Right Home Group, and I stayed sober. Because I identified with everybody. We had all been divorced, we had all been in jail. We're all unemployable. And we all did drugs. So I went to this home group. This was and I tried, and I was going for about 2 or 3 weeks, but I was half doing it. And then I said, "Nah, you know, I'm never going to make this. It's like dieting, you know. I'm going to lose 50 pounds in 2 months." And then the third day, somebody gives me a Krispy Kreme donut, and I said, "I'm never going to make it. Screw it." You know? And so that's what would happen. I would try AA, and then by the third day, "Oh, this is for the birds," you know. And then I would drink or drug or something. So February 10th, I decided to steal a truck with a friend, and we were going to head to Florida. And we robbed a bunch of bars, and he would keep one person busy. I'd take the money out of the register, or vice versa. Or we'd steal booze, and then there was a half a dozen Colombian retail merchants. Then I would say, "He wants to buy something," he'd give it to me, and then we'd run. And then we got in this truck that we stole, headed south, and we made it about 10 miles, and the alternator went. It was dark, late at night, and we couldn't get anywhere. So we did some of the drugs and booze, and then I saw the 800 number on the side of the truck for maintenance. I said, "Let's call the maintenance guy." So they towed the truck away, and we had no place at all. We were stuck in town, and that's where all these people were going to be looking for us come the morning. And so I knew there was a 10 o'clock AA meeting at this hospital in Port Jefferson, and I went there to hide out. I had to get off the street because my life was in serious trouble. So I went into the hospital to the AA meeting where they served coffee and bagels. That's why I would go there. I used to steal needles from the hospital and grab a bagel. And this person shared, and I'm sitting in the corner eating the bagel and coffee, and this person's telling a story. I can tell you her name is Beatrice. Another old person, like 50. And I don't know what she said, and then she called on me, the first person. She said, "Well, that young guy with the red hair, I like this." "Who are you, sure?" And my intention was to stand up and just say, you know, "Nice story, good luck to you." And because what do you say? And especially at 10 in the morning. You know? But I stood up and I said, "I need help." I don't know how that came out, but that's what I did. I just said, "I need help," and I sat back down. And the next guy to share was a guy named Joe Rouse. He's passed away. He had 7 years of sobriety when he died. And he said, "You see me after the meeting." And he kept getting up during the meeting, going out to his car. I could see through the window. And he would grab you and take you out to the car, or you. And he was taking me and opening up the trunk, giving him something. And I said, "Oh, I got the right guy. Is this going to help me?" I figured like he was a town dealer, you know. He's like, they saw I was withdrawing and everything else. I had that nice color yellow, not from the sun. You know? And after the meeting, he took me and, remember, he took me to breakfast to a diner. He said, "You hungry?" I said, "No." So he ordered breakfast. He said, "You can have my toast. I don't need toast." I said, "Oh, sure." So I ate the toast. And he says, and then when the waitress came, he says, "I told you I don't want bacon." He said, "That's okay." And then he said, "Why don't you have my bacon?" And he did that every morning. He'd pick me up, take me to meetings. And why does she keep bringing me bacon, you know? And because he was getting food in me. And he took me to meetings. And he saved my life. He's in the big book, they call him Eskimos. He was the first Eskimo that I ran into. And that was on February 11th. 1988. And on February 12th, this girl named Joan came into AA. That was her first day. And then on March 1st, we thought if we lived together, we could stay sober better. So my sobriety date is April 23rd. And I spoke this summer up in New York on Long Island, and Joan was there. She had, I don't know how much time, but she had a good time. So that was nice, too. Insanity, huh? So, but Joe took me around to meetings, and then on Sunday, I ended up joining the Shoreham group that became my home group. And on Sunday, we had a double speaker meeting. There'd be a coffee break in between, an hour and a half meeting. And on Friday, we had a step meeting. And Joe would pick me up every day and then bring me to the meeting. And we'd go to three or four meetings throughout the day. There were no detoxes or halfway houses at the time that I could get into. All the smart drunks had already checked themselves in and all the beds were used up. And what Joe was doing in the back of his car, by the way, is giving people socks and cigarettes and underwear and t-shirts because he had a commitment. And he called it an avocation. He didn't work in the winter. He was a heavy equipment operator. And what he would do was give everybody supplies at these halfway houses and detoxes, and he donated all this stuff. And so he could help me. He got other people to do the commitment. And it's about doing and working hard. That's how Joe stays sober, and he's helped me how to do that. So I joined the Shoreham group, and it was a Sunday. And at this time, I no longer was living on the streets. I had moved in with my parents. They lived on Long Island in a town called, or a development called Leisure Village. And it was for old people. I used to call it Seizure Village. Because every night there was an ambulance coming in. Now at home I see an ambulance, I wonder, is it for me? So, we're at the Shoreham group at St. Mark's Church on Sunday night, and the first speaker was just about over, and I tapped Joe, he was in front of me, I said, Joe, I'm going to go home at halftime. We had been to three or four meetings that day. I was maybe two, 3 weeks sober, something like that. And this guy taps me behind, and he says, are you a member of this group? And I said, yeah. I figured the guy needed help. Yeah. He could see my sobriety. He saw that. And he said, the meeting starts with the preamble and ends with the Our Father. You should be here a half hour early to greet people and set up, and then stay a half hour late and help clean up. And I thought, the nerve. This bones. So the nerve to talk to me like that. Can you imagine? So the meeting ended. I stayed for the whole meeting. I couldn't hold the coffee. My hands were shaking so bad because I just wanted to beat this guy to death. To talk to me that way. And so then I stayed after the meeting, and I'm cleaning up, not because he said to, but because I'm waiting for him. And I'm looking and I'm watching him, and he left with possibly six of the biggest guys in the meeting, and for sure he was afraid. Turns out they were all iron workers, and he sponsored all of them. So the next Friday, that whole week, my dad would give me money for the meeting, money for cigarettes, and I held some of it aside. And that Friday, I went to the bank and I got two rolls of nickels and I had them in my hands because I was going to kill him. And I got to the meeting half hour early, and not because he said so, but I really didn't remember what he looked like and I wanted to make sure I could. But I thought about him the whole week. And then, And then sure enough, in comes the idiot, you know, and walking in. And he said, "Honey, glad you're here." I said, "Can we go outside and talk?" He said, "Sure." And I took my coat off. I have the nickels in my hand, in my pocket. And then it's on the way out, it's dawned on me that how am I going to hurt him that bad and come back and get my coat, you know? But I'm going to hurt him. And I don't know if I'm going to hit him from behind or how I'm going to do it. And we get outside, and I got the nickels. And so 5 minutes later, I came in and got my coat, and I had a sponsor. And I don't much remember what his spiel was, but it was good. And I heard that you had to ask, do they have a sponsor? Because you don't want to have a sponsor that doesn't have a sponsor. Because then you're just back into the illness and the sickness. And he told me, he said, yes, he told me his name was Tom. He had 7 years at the time. I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago. Now he's got 35, 36. He said, he points across the room. He said, "That's Crazy Joe. He's got 15 years. He's my sponsor." And then he points to like two seats next to Joe. He says, "That's Bob Dyer. He's got 25. That's Joe's sponsor." Said, "Terry McCormick has 33. He's Bob's sponsor." And he says, "Kurt has 40 years. He's Terry's sponsor." He said, "Terry's sponsor was Bill W." He said, "If you screw this up, I'll punch your heart out." His exact words. And he told me I had to get active in AA. I went to a meeting with Joe Rouse, and people said, I had 30 days and I picked up. I had a week and I picked up. I had 9 months and I picked up. I had a year and I picked up. And I'm listening to all of this at this one particular meeting. And I said, "Joe, what makes all these people go back out again?" And he kept it simple. He said, "Everything AA gives us, that's what makes us go back out. The more we get the girlfriend back, we get the car, God, we get the house, you know, and then we got Cadillac problems, you know. Like we get the little dog, you know." My Shih Tzu shed all over my BMW. I had to call my sponsor, you know. And all we were trying to do was just go one day without a drink, but then we got all these things. So every time I got a thing, I got another commitment. I just got more active. My sponsor told me there was a retreat group. AA doesn't lend its name to any outside activity. So they have a Matt Talbot retreat group. It's named after this guy, Matt Talbot, an Irish drunk. That's redundant. And he died, and Alcoholics Anonymous was looking to have a retreat, and so they named it after him. And I joined Group 33 out on Long Island. We used to go way out east. And I was at a retreat, and I was only a couple months sober. And the retreat master gave us a definition of alcoholism. He said, "It's a denial for the need of others." He said, "Alcoholism is a disease of isolation." And I understood that. It's about the only thing I've ever written in my big book. I'm not a note taker. I don't highlight. I don't underline. I don't do that sort of stuff. But that impressed me because I identified with it strongly. And that's what I do. I isolate. I do whatever I can to isolate. As a kid, I had a make-believe friend and I never talked to him. All I want to do is do whatever I can to push you away. And I come here, go away. And that's what I do. And I found that out. And so I joined the Matt Talbot group, and then I got active, and I did meetings, and I had commitments, and we had to speak. And I kept getting things, and as I got things, I kept getting more involved. You know, when I was drinking, when I had that first drink, I had a beer, and then we were in a bar having, we had a pitcher of beer. I was about 15 or 16 years old. And somebody said, have a shot. I said, it's not like I said, well, I already had a beer. They said, have a shot, it'll make you feel good. Oh, okay. So I had the beer and the shot. A few years later, I had the beer and the shot, and somebody said, here, smoke this. I said, well, I had the beer and the shot. They said, yeah, but it'll make you feel good. So I said, okay, so I smoked that. I was getting tired and hungry, and they said, well, take one of these, it'll pick you up. I said, okay, but I already had the beer and the shot and the joint. That's okay, have that. But it'll make you feel good. And I kept doing more and more. I don't need Alcoholics Anonymous. If they came out with a program called More Anonymous, I would join that. I could stand up here and say, I'm Bob Haywood, I can't get enough. And aren't we all mostly like that? You know, it's a disease of more. But when we get sober, you go to a meeting on a Friday night, listen to Jordan, the marvelous speaker, and somebody says, hey, let's go to the Saturday morning meeting down at 54 and 19. You know, I already went to a meeting Friday night. Yeah, but it'll make you feel good.
I don't need to feel that. Maybe I'll feel good Monday. I'll go to the Monday night meeting.
And somehow we stop wanting to feel good, you know? I did it when I was drinking, but I stopped doing it here. What I came in for in AA was to have a life that I have now, and I didn't know that. What I like to end with is this, I'd wake up in the morning with that incomprehensible demoralization that they talk about in the big book. And I just, I didn't want to go on, I didn't want to live, I didn't want to die, I didn't know what. And I didn't want to do this ever again. And my chest would be tight, my stomach tight, it's just, nothing was right, I couldn't face anybody. And around 12 o'clock, I'd pull the car into the parking lot of a bar. And the tires would roll over the gravel, you can hear that noise. And I just knew things were gonna be okay. And then I'd go into the bar and I'd get that first drink down, which didn't go down good. And once it stayed down, I'd have that second drink. And then I'd have the third drink and I'd start breathing easier. And once I had that third drink, I began to know a new freedom and a new happiness. Once I had the third drink, I didn't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Once I had that third drink, I could comprehend the word serenity and know peace. Once I had that third drink, I could see that no matter how far down the scale I went, my experience could benefit others. And that feeling of uselessness and self-pity went away. What I'm saying is I got all the promises on page 83 and 84 the minute I had that third drink. And I got them on a daily basis, and that's what kept me drinking, was the promises. And what I had to do was stay undrunk long enough to experience the promises of sobriety. And then life became better. A slip in AA is not just picking up a drink. A slip in AA is giving away all those promises. You know, my friend John says it seems so silly to clap for people who don't drink. It's like congratulating a cowboy with hemorrhoids for not riding his horse. So a slip in Alcoholics Anonymous is more than just drinking. A slip in Alcoholics Anonymous is giving away these wonderful promises that are ours to keep. I heard a slip in Al-Anon is a moment of compassion. Thank you for letting me share.